from stopping us from having civil disobedience in this city that refuses to have justice for Breonna Taylor, her family, or her community.
What are you demanding now as we wrap up? And then we're going to do part two to talk about what you're going to be doing in the state legislature around the killing of Breonna Taylor.
Yes, and thank you for that question. As we face court tomorrow afternoon, Tuesday afternoon, we are clear that we will continue to demand justice for Breonna Taylor. What that looks like right now is exactly what Attorney Crump said. We need a new special prosecutor who is independent, who is not politically motivated, who is not directly tied to Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump. We need an independent investigator who will listen to the witnesses who lived where Breonna Taylor lived, in her apartment complex. There are many witnesses who need to be heard because Breonna Taylor has not received justice.
Attica Scott, I want to thank you for being with us. We'll do part two and post online at democracynow.org, Democratic State Representative in Kentucky. And that does it for our broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe, wear a mask, save lives. Happy birthday, Rebecca Staley.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of L'Arche Portland Benefit Celebration on Saturday, October 24th from 6 to 7 p.m., streaming online. This benefit will highlight the gift of individuals with and without intellectual disabilities. There will be musical performances, an auction, and testimonials covering the mission and impact of L'Arche. Again, that's L'Arche Portland Benefit Celebration, Saturday, October 24th from 6 to 7 p.m., streaming online. You can find more information at kboo.fm on the right side of our homepage under Community Events.
This is your community-supported radio station, KBOO Portland. Before we get going with our programming, I want to remind everyone that you can donate today at kboo.fm/give. We aren't in the station to take your calls, but you can show your support by giving online. Again, that's kboo.fm/give. Or you can also mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Thank you.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, protests in Portland against police brutality and systemic racism continued over the weekend. President Trump says he will be returning to the White House after spending three nights in the hospital, and a new study warns that the Amazon rainforest could be turning into a savanna. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, October 5th, 2020. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Althea Billings. Over the weekend, the Oregon Health Authority reported 620 new cases of COVID-19. State health officials also reported 9 new deaths over the weekend. On Monday, the Oregon Health Authority reported 288 new cases of COVID, bringing the state's total number of confirmed and presumptive cases up to 35,049. State health officials reported no new deaths on Monday. Oregon last reported no new deaths on September 28th, so the state's death toll remains at 572 people. Multnomah County had the highest number of new cases with 61, followed by Marion County with 52, and Washington County with 35 new cases. Nationally, as of Monday afternoon, more than 7.4 million people in the United States have been infected with the coronavirus. At least 209,000 people across the country have died. The coronavirus outbreak in the Trump administration continues to spread as White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany and two of her deputies joined the list of aides close to the president who have tested positive for COVID-19. Trump said on Monday that he would be returning to the White House after having spent 3 nights in the hospital. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened over 35 million people in nearly every country. As of Monday, more than 1 million people have died across the globe. Protests in Portland calling out police brutality and racial injustice have continued for roughly 4 months, only being briefly interrupted by smoke and hazardous air quality brought on by wildfires in the region. On Friday night, demonstrators gathered at Laurelhurst Park around 8 p.m. before marching to the Penumbra Kelly Building. The Penumbra Kelly Building houses Portland Police Bureau specialist units and the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. Officers told protesters that they did not have a permit to march in the street, so they would need to stay on sidewalks and obey traffic lights and signs or be subjected to arrest. Social media video shows a traffic officer approach a car on East Burnside Street and Northeast 47th Avenue. The crowd surrounded the officer, who then accelerated through bystanders, hitting a woman who was in front of him. Police identified the woman after she was taken to a hospital to have her injuries evaluated. 22-year-old Teliana Linzeth was arrested and booked into the Multnomah County Detention Center for riot, interfering with a peace officer, and disorderly conduct. In total, 4 people were arrested on Friday night. On Saturday, a silent candle-lit vigil was held in honor of ICE detainees in Portland. The vigil began near the Burnside Bridge, then silently moved down the waterfront to Salmon Street Springs. On Sunday night, demonstrators marched from Tom McCall Waterfront Park to the new Multnomah County Courthouse, and then to the Central Precinct in downtown Portland. 6 people were arrested during demonstrations on Sunday. The USDA says requiring a letter from the president be included with food given to needy families during an election campaign does not violate the federal Hatch Act. Andrea Sears has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Anti-hunger advocates are expressing alarm at a new USDA requirement that millions of boxes of surplus food include a letter from President Donald Trump. The letters, claiming credit for the program funded by the CARES Act, started appearing in some farmers to families' food box program deliveries over the summer. But as of last month, the agency has required private contractors, including not-for-profit groups, to include the letter when packing and distributing the food. According to Joel Berg, CEO of Hunger Free America, this may put organizations that are legally prohibited from promoting political candidates in an untenable position.
It's essentially blackmailing nonprofit groups that are doing this food distribution to say, either you help advance the president's reelection, or you have to say, oh, we're not feeding hungry people.
Congressional Democrats say the letter may violate the federal Hatch Act, prohibiting political activities by executive branch employees, but the USDA says it does not. Berg contends the letter, which credits the president with prioritizing sending food to families during the pandemic and includes some suggestions on staying safe from the coronavirus, fails to pass a simple test.
On a purely legal matter, the question is, does something have a governmental purpose? There's no governmental purpose. There's no common sense purpose. The only logical purpose would be to aid a reelection campaign, and that would be illegal.
He adds when he worked at the USDA during the Clinton administration, they removed even the USDA labels from food being sent to food banks. While the contractors packing the food are now required to include the letters in every farmers to families food box package, Berg notes they may not be required when the food is finally delivered.
We're being told food banks are getting guidance that they can take the letters out of the boxes, and I hope many of them do. We don't take sides in campaigns one way or another. We just don't think our tax dollars should be doing that either.
Some food banks have reportedly consulted lawyers to make sure the letters don't jeopardize their nonprofit status or violate election laws. For Public News Service, I'm Andrea Sears.
2 federal lawsuits have been filed to overturn an executive order issued last Thursday by Texas Governor Greg Abbott that would restrict ballot drop boxes to 1 per county. Roz Brown has more on the story with the Public News Service.
The head of the Texas League of Women Voters does not think a last-minute directive to limit ballot drop boxes will stop residents from voting on November 3rd. Two separate federal lawsuits have been filed to overturn an executive order issued last Thursday by Governor Greg Abbott that restricts ballot drop boxes to one per county. Those using drop boxes for absentee ballots are likely to be elderly voters or people with disabilities who are trying to avoid exposure to COVID-19. Grace Shameen, president of the League of Women Voters Texas, calls the governor's actions a perfect example of voter suppression.
It's an example of voter suppression of people who have disabilities and people over 65. It impacts people of color, poor people with no transportation to get to this one site.
Shameen says for many rural counties, one drop box is plenty. But a single box in a huge county such as Harris will create long drive times, traffic congestion, and parking issues. The governor has said his order will enhance ballot security and prevent voter fraud. The League of Women Voters of Texas is represented by the Campaign Legal Center in challenging the governor's directive. In Harris County, where ballot drop boxes will be reduced from 12 to 1, more than 40% of residents are Latino and nearly 20% are Black. Shameen believes the governor's order will backfire because voters will be even more determined to take part in the democratic process.
I don't think the voters of Texas are going to throw up their hands. I think that this makes the voters of Texas angry and that there is nothing that is going to stop them from voting in this election.
Abbott expanded early voting by 6 days, but others in his party are suing to prevent that expansion. State Republicans also have successfully blocked Democrats' attempts to expand mail-in voting. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
President Trump's COVID-19 diagnosis is raising questions about White House transparency, and Vice President Mike Pence will debate Senator Kamala Harris this week. With more on those stories, we go to Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
He's come down with coronavirus, and a number of his associates have as well. And it just doesn't seem especially surprising to the voters. And it's just not inciting the sympathy that I think would otherwise exist.
Pollster Matt McDermott with Whitman Insights Strategies on this weekend's polls. Former Vice President Joe Biden is still leading President Donald Trump by double digits. In a Reuters and Ipsos poll, 65% of respondents believe Trump could have taken precautions to avoid the virus. That included about half of the Republicans who responded.
This was just bound to happen. I mean, we've all seen the videos for months now of him holding White House events, him holding indoor rallies, him holding indoor fundraisers, where no one's wearing a mask, everyone's sitting close together.
On Sunday, the president took a brief motorcade outside Walter Reed National Military Medical Center to wave to supporters. White House physician Dr. Sean Conley explains the seemingly contradictory information he gave that the president is recovering well while also being treated with medicines usually reserved for serious conditions.
I was trying to reflect the upbeat attitude that the team, the president, that his course of illness has had.
Conley forecasted a possible return to the White House as early as today, but health experts say that doesn't mean the president is out of the woods. Dr. Ingrid Katz with Harvard's Medical Center and Global Health Institute talks about the president's combination of treatments, an experimental, quote, antibody cocktail, antiviral remdesivir, and dexamethasone, a steroid.
Those are generally reserved for people who require respiratory support to breathe, so require supplemental oxygen. And that is an indication that he has at least moderate, if not severe, COVID. And so I think that these are increasingly concerning signs about the severity of his illness.
More than 10 other people in Trump's orbit have also tested positive. The RNC chair, a top aide, a White House staffer, his campaign manager, advisor Kellyanne Conway, former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, three Republican senators, Mike Lee, Ron Johnson, and Tom Tillis. Eight of those traced back to the president's in-person Supreme Court announcement of Judge Amy Coney Barrett last week. Cleveland also reported 11 new cases stemming from people who helped set up last week's debate. Trump's public events are canceled for the foreseeable future. Vice President Mike Pence continues to campaign. He debates vice presidential candidate Senator Kamala Harris in Salt Lake City Wednesday night. Now, some Harris supporters are suggesting the senator follow Jamie Harrison's example. This weekend, the Democratic candidate from South Carolina brought his own plexiglass divider to debate longtime Republican Senator Lindsey Graham.
I am taking it seriously. That's why I put this plexiglass up, because, you know, it's not just about me. It's about the people in my life that I have to take care of as well. My two boys, my wife, my grandmother.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
You You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in Depth. We'll be hearing from election experts who weigh in on the coronavirus pandemic's impact on this upcoming election, as well as a segment fact-checking COVID-19. At 6, stick around, we'll hear Labor Radio. At 6:30, Prison Pipeline. And at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 55 degrees. Tomorrow will be sunny with a high of 77. Today in history, in 1989, the Dalai Lama, the exiled religious and political leader of Tibet, was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in recognition of his nonviolent campaign to end the Chinese domination of Tibet. The quote of the day is from the Dalai Lama, who said, quote, "Compassion is the radicalism of our time." A lawsuit has been filed by the family of an Indigenous woman in Quebec who was taunted by hospital staff as she died, and Sisters in Spirit Day remembers missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. With those stories and more, we turn to Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The family of a Quebec woman who died last week in a hospital while being taunted by staff is filing a lawsuit. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the family also gave an emotional statement on her death, calling for justice.
Joyce Etchequan died in Quebec's Joliet Hospital. She had complained about stomach pains. She also used her phone to self-film while at the hospital. It showed a deeply distressed Etchequan screaming in pain and hospital staff who berated her with racist remarks and calling her stupid. Two hospital staff have since been fired over the incident. A coroner's inquest is also underway. A visibly upset Carole Dubé is Etchequan's husband.
The racist systemic
Dubé says he's convinced she died because of systemic racism at the Joliet Hospital. The Quebec government says there will be a public inquiry, but the Premier, François Legault, refuses to admit there is systemic racism. Over the weekend, hundreds of people took part in a protest rally in Montreal.
We are here, we are many, and we are angry.
Ghislaine Picard is with the Assembly of First Nations.
It's an issue of human rights. It's an issue where, you know, our human rights of our people have been denied. And we won't say it often enough. The system is failing and has failed our people for too long. And for changes to happen, then the political class have to wake up.
The video has led to widespread indignation, several inquiries, and a lawsuit. And it has highlighted systemic racism in healthcare, not just in Quebec, but in other provinces as well. Native leaders say they're not surprised by what happened to Etchequan, some saying for every Joyce Etchequan that comes forward, there is 100 who have not been heard. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Walks, vigils, and other events were held across Canada Sunday to observe Sisters in Spirit Day, which honors missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. The Native Women's Association of Canada held a virtual gathering due to COVID-19 safety concerns. Families remembered their missing and murdered loved ones. Maggie Sidewink talked about her sister, Sonia, who went missing in 1994 and was later found murdered. She encouraged families, saying there's hope to move forward, heal, and find a collective voice.
It is our responsibility as families to take the actions necessary. We can't wait for police. We can't wait for the government to do those actions for us. And vigils are one way, but other ways are actually when we go out and search for the missing, when we lend, if we can, you know, be a part of the fundraisers that families need to do in order to raise those funds. We need to join the fight, and we need to join in any way that we can to find useful in helping others heal.
Advocates say they're working with families, Indigenous groups, and governments. The Native Women's Association of Canada is calling for the creation of an investigative unit to examine cold cases, the creation of a database, and a healing initiative run by Indigenous women. The House Natural Resources Subcommittee on Energy and Mineral Resources and the Subcommittee on Water, Oceans, and Wildlife are hosting a virtual forum Monday on climate change in the Arctic. The panel includes Alaska Native guests. The melting Arctic climate change impacts on people and wildlife is being streamed on Facebook and YouTube. The forum is being led by House Democrats. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A new study published in the scientific journal Nature Communications warns that the Amazon rainforest is nearing an existential shift from being a rainforest to a savanna. The study cites climate change and extensive deforestation as the causes of this shift. As the climate changes, parts of the rainforest receive significantly less rainfall. Researchers say about 40% of the rainforest is at a rainfall level characteristic of a savanna, or a tropical grassland. Rainforests support far more plant and animal life than savannas. They also absorb far more carbon dioxide from the air. Any change to the Amazon's ability to capture carbon could speed climate change all over the planet. The shift from one biome to another will not happen overnight. It may be decades before the process is actually complete. But experts warn, once it's started, the process is not one that is easily reversed. Reporting from The Guardian points to the ancient biome shift of the Sahara Desert as an example. Thousands of years ago, the Sahara was a lake-filled grassland that slowly dried out. Now it's the largest hot desert in the world. This year's fires in the Amazon were reportedly the worst in a decade, and rainfall levels have decreased significantly in much of the forest. Tree cover affects rainfall in tropical forests, where trees make their own rain. Leaves give off water vapor, which falls as rain in other parts of the forest. With fewer trees due to logging and wildfires, the rainforest cannot sustain its own rain nearly as well. Drier forests are more flammable, and the cycle continues. Scientists working on the study say the Amazon is at the so-called tipping point of entering a feedback loop of drying out that will be nearly impossible to stop. One of the co-authors of the paper, Ingo Fetzer, of the Stockholm Resilience Center, warned of the sensitivity of rainforests worldwide. They said, quote, "Given that rainforests host the majority of all global species, all of this will be forever lost." Bright yellow barriers that lift from the seabed could save a European city from climate change. Plus, there's new hope around the plague of plastics piling up in our oceans. With those stories and more, we go to This Week in Water.
A better way to recycle plastics? Think Pac-Man. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report.
I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Venice, Italy may have a new lease on life. The famous city of canals is sinking and has been threatened by rising sea levels. But last week, it got a chance to test a new system of gates to hold back water, and they worked.
Reuters reports that a network of 78 bright yellow barriers at the entrance of the Venice Lagoon lifted from the seabed to protect the city against a rising tide driven by strong winds and rain.
The forecast had warned of a high tide, and a Venetian official told the New York Times that if the barriers had not been raised, visitors to St. Mark's Square would have been wading in a foot and a half of water.
Skeptics had wondered whether the system, plagued by corruption, cost overruns, and prolonged delays, would be up to the task. But the barriers worked, even though they weren't fully operational.
Some say the barriers won't fully solve the threat to the city from climate change. The floodgates may have to stay up so often, it might turn the Venice Lagoon into a swamp.
But on Saturday, Venetians were celebrating as hopes were raised in a city suffering from a fall in tourism due to the coronavirus.
There's new hope around the plague of plastics piling up in our oceans and waterways. Scientists have developed a plastic-eating cocktail of enzymes that could revolutionize recycling.
Researchers had already discovered one enzyme that could break down plastics, but recent work at the National Renewable Energy Lab, or NREL, and the University of Portsmouth found that by tying two enzymes together, they could speed up the process to make it 6 times faster.
The method is like joining two Pac-Mans by a string, increasing the speed at which the enzymes gobble up plastic. The breakthrough would make recycling commercially feasible.
The enzyme cocktail could break down plastic to its original component parts, making it infinitely recyclable. Since plastic is made from petrochemicals, the process could play a role in reducing not only global pollution, but also greenhouse gases.
There are numerous reservoirs around the world basking in the sun, but according to new research, those water bodies hold huge potential for producing energy.
Scientists at NREL have shown that by deploying floating solar panels on the hundreds of thousands of hydropower reservoirs around the world, they could produce as much as 7.6 terawatts a year, almost half of the global electricity demand.
About 2 years ago, NREL estimated that floating solar in the U.S. could provide about 10% of the country's energy consumption, even if the panels covered only a quarter of the total surface area of available water bodies.
In this new study, the NREL team said that by producing solar power during dry seasons, hydropower operators could conserve more of their impounded water by not sending it through turbines. Floating solar is also feasible because it would use existing power lines for transmission.
Floating solar is growing in the U.S., with one of the largest arrays recently starting production at a water treatment plant in New Jersey.
And the U.S. Army has jumped into the game, announcing last week it will build the largest floating solar plant in the Southeast at Fort Bragg in North Carolina.
In last week's edition, we brought you a story about zombie tropical storms, weather events that appear to have died but come back to life. This week, it's zombie fires.
Scientists have discovered that fires in the Arctic can smolder underground in carbon-rich peat over the winter, then reignite on the surface as soon as the weather warms in the spring.
An international team of researchers has been tracking fire activity in the Russian Arctic and also found as the tundra in the far north becomes hotter and drier, vegetation types not typically thought of as fuels, like dwarf shrubs and moss, are starting to catch fire. Even wet landscapes like bogs and marshes are also becoming vulnerable to burning.
More than half of the fires detected in Siberia this year were north of the Arctic Circle on permafrost, which locks in enormous amounts of carbon from ancient biomass, making the fires of global concern. And finally, blue whales are the largest animals on Earth. Every year, the ones in the Pacific migrate over 4,000 miles from summer feeding grounds in the Northwest to winter breeding grounds in the warmer waters of Mexico and Central America.
And according to new research from Stanford, their singing pattern is a clue as to when that migration might happen.
During the daytime in the summer, the whales gorge on krill to prepare for their long journey. And at night, they sing.
But the recent research has revealed that once the decision is made to head south, the singing pattern flips. The whales switch to crooning in the daytime.
Why whales sing is still a mystery and generally thought to be about mating. But this new research suggests it might also be to do with food sources and migration.
Blue whales are spread over vast distances while foraging. By listening to their brethren at night, it might help them gather intel about good food stocks in their region. Also, hearing that other whales are on the move could signal it's time for everyone to stop eating and make a break for warmer waters.
The researchers say understanding changing whale song patterns could help reduce the number of ship strikes along the California coast by predicting when and where migrations are happening.
The songs could also reveal how the animals are responding to climate change as they shift their feeding grounds to find food sources.
Just how flexible and adaptable the whales are to warming oceans could indicate where and whether they'll be singing in the future.
That's it for this week in water. We'll catch you next time.
Thank you.
You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, your stories, and your tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Samantha Law. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Roz Brown, Antonia Gonzalez, and Andrea Sears. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's The Word with Abe and Tracy covering politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist. At 9, we'll hear Alternative Radio. That features lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, we'll hear Stage and Studio. Host Dimae Roberts presents The Breast Cancer Monologues, a documentary for Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Then at 11:30, Art Focus features interviews with artists, curators, and critics talking about art, how it's made, and what it means. All of these KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are made possible by support from our members. We are currently in our fall membership drive, so if you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Last Thursday, the National Task Force on Election Crises met with the goal of ensuring a free and fair general election this fall. Made up of a number of experts, the group believes this election to be a most crucial and challenging event in the history of the United States. Their singular goal at this time is to ensure there is a peaceful transition or continuation of power on January 20th, 2021. These weekly briefings from the National Task Force on Election Crises seek to offer important legal context about specific election scenarios that are possible for the 2020 election. Three experts from the task force were on hand to answer questions related to the transition of power. Those experts were Joshua Geltzer, Executive Director and Visiting Professor at Georgetown Law's Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection, Vanita Gupta, President and CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, and Adav Noti, Senior Director for Trial Litigation and Chief of Staff at the Campaign Legal Center. First, Adav Noti spoke about the auspicious date of January 6th, which is the day Congress convenes in a special joint session to actually count the electoral votes from the election and figure out who won.
There's basically three things that can happen in that joint session, other than just three things that would deviate from the routine. One would be if a state sends in more than one set of electoral votes. One would be if a state sends in one set of electoral votes and there's a dispute over whether it's valid. And the other would be if a state doesn't send in any electoral votes. So I'm gonna just talk about each of those three scenarios. So the basic structure of this congressional counting session is that Congress meets in a joint session, both chambers together, presided over by the president of the Senate, who is the vice president. But that joint session has actually no decision-making power. It's essentially ceremonial. The vice president is directed constitutionally to open up the envelopes from each state, and they go in alphabetical order. And then they are read and tallied by tellers that are appointed by the houses. And then the result is announced. The way that a dispute would be raised during that session would be if a member of the House and a member of the Senate filed a written objection during this alphabetical roll call of states, objecting to the electoral votes that have been announced from that state. At that point, the joint session suspends and the two chambers divide and they meet separately and they vote on which slate coming out of that state is valid. The rules vary depending on whether there are two submissions from the state or multiple submissions from the state or just one. If there's just one submission from the state and there's an objection as to whether it's valid, both houses have to agree to reject the slate. So if they don't both vote separately to reject the slate, it gets counted and then they reconvene in the joint session. If there is more than one slate, though, the two houses can either agree on which one is valid, in which case that's what prevails, or if they disagree, then the law contains a tiebreak provision, which says if there's more than one slate and the two houses disagree, then the one that gets counted is the one that was certified by the executive of the state, which is usually going to be the governor. So that's the basic rule. Any objection is raised, they divide, they vote, and they come back, and the decision is made pursuant to those decision-making rules. And then the alphabetical roll call proceeds until the end. The only other scenario to mention is the one where there are no electoral votes submitted by a state. Now, obviously, there's nothing to count there in Congress, but as has been mentioned quite a bit publicly in recent days, there is a constitutional provision that says if no candidate gets a majority of electoral votes, the House of Representatives decides the president, voting each state delegation getting one vote. So the question then is if a state doesn't appoint any electors, and as a result, each candidate ends up with less than 270 electoral votes, which is the maximum number authorized, does the election go to the House? And the answer to that, although it's not 100% clear, is probably no. Because what the constitutional provision says is that the election goes to the House if no candidate gets a majority of electors votes from the electors who were appointed, and that's the constitutional word. So if a state hasn't submitted any electoral votes because it never decided on who its electors were and never appointed them, then that state's theoretical electoral votes don't go into the denominator of the calculation of whether somebody got a majority, which is different from if they were appointed and the votes were submitted to Congress and not counted. Those would count in the denominator and not in the numerator, and you could end up with less than a majority. You know, what's unfortunate is that it is at all possible. I think in other elections, it would have been unthinkable. And, you know, the fact that we have state actors and candidates floating it as a possibility is unfortunate. That doesn't mean it's likely, and that doesn't mean it would succeed. I think it's not likely, and I think it wouldn't succeed. For the reasons I was just alluding to, which are that it's illegal under federal law for a legislature to appoint electors after the election, except in very, very narrow situations, which is not what's at issue here. And it would violate the constitutional rights of the voter. So that's a real disincentive for state legislature to even go down that road, because it would be in violation of the Constitution and would probably not prevail. So all of that, in addition to the political blowback that one could imagine if a state decided to just overrule its own vote tallies, are all reasons why I think it's not a particularly likely scenario and not likely to succeed if anyone tries it.
Task Force expert Vanita Gupta responded to a question, which was, can a state legislature come along and override the will of the voters in that state? Here she is discussing what she terms a contingent election.
A contingent election is when happens when no presidential ticket has the majority of electoral votes at the end of the process that Congress undertakes. And the 12th Amendment provides that the House of Representatives is going to choose the president and that the Senate will choose the vice president. The acting president means it's, if there's no clear winner by noon on January 20th, then federal law provides for an acting president until the disputes are resolved. And in this case, in our country, the Speaker of the House is in the first in line, assuming that the vice president position is also undecided. And the current president does not stay in office. There have been comments made by many former Secret Service agents, and also federal law provides that, and as I wrote in a recent op-ed, that the Secret Service will have to escort anyone who does not fit the description of the president or acting president on January 20th. Just before we break open, though, for questions, I think it's important to kind of take stock of the moment we find ourselves in, which is that there has been a necessity, as I said, to really dig into these questions to understand how this could work after November 3rd in a way that feels fairly unprecedented for this moment in the country. And part of that is really driven, and well, I should say no small part has been driven by concerns, comments made by the president about whether he will accept the results of the election, attacks on some of our democratic infrastructure over the last several months. But what is really important, even as we kind of walk people through the federal law that is in place and the way that the system actually is shored up to prevent interference in determining the outcome of the general election, it's really important to say over and over again that the candidates themselves have almost no role in this process. And that while people may make claims to powers that they and make threats according to what they may or may not do, the reality is actually that the candidates don't have powers to determine the outcome of the election. Neither the president nor Joe Biden can decide this election, the voters do. And it's really important as media that even as you are talking to the public, explaining all of the various contingencies and what the system says in the case of various crises, that we are also in this moment really giving assurance to voters that they in this country, in a democracy, in the United States of America, are the ones to determine the outcome of this election. And in nearly every state, local boards of election count the ballots. State election authorities verify those counts. Governors and secretaries of states certify that the final tally is correct. Both Josh and Nadav walked us through how this happens. The Electoral College doesn't depend on whether the incumbent accepts the results or not. New Congress in January is going to be counting that tally transparently, and there are firewalls built in for very good reason to separate this process from both candidates. And so the scenarios that we're walking through today are really deep into the rabbit hole of crisis possibilities. And even I think in the worst case scenarios that can really, cause great alarm, there are rules and procedures that can and must govern what happens. And it's really important, and I cannot overstate this, it's really important that voters understand this, that while a lot about our system is complicated, and we've tried to simplify it, but even we know it's still complicated when we talk about it, this isn't a free-for-all, and the rules don't change cycle to cycle, and they're not idiosyncratic candidate to candidate. Voters can and should trust that their vote is going to count. There's been a lot of work done since COVID to ensure that voters have options and expanded options given the pandemic, working with Republican and Democratic secretaries of states at the state and local level on things like expanded mail-in balloting, which has been used by states across the country for years, including Colorado and Hawaii, Oregon, Washington, Utah, and many others with freely, fairly, effectively, and that the election is going to proceed according to the rule of law. So it's incumbent on all of us to say this and to make sure that voters have the information they need about how they're going to vote and what plan they're going to use to vote. even as we talk about some of these kind of challenges, and I hope there's a way to reassure voters that there is a system in this country that has withstood a lot of personalities and a lot of different threats, and that is the system that we have in place today.
Joshua Geltzer touched on the prevalence of norms in past elections, such as when the losing candidate concedes to the victor based on how results are looking on election night. Here he is in a little more detail.
Even as fraught as elections have been recently, as tense, as long as it took to get things decided in 2000, as surprising as it's been to have a couple of elections in the past two decades in which the popular vote has not actually matched the Electoral College vote, for all of that, a lot of norms were respected and have entrenched themselves as expectations now on the parts of voters. But by voters, I actually just mean all of us. We're all and so let me give one example. The idea of conceding, of making a phone call that says, I'm watching TV, you, my hard-fought opposition candidate, you're watching TV, and it seems like things are going your way. And so I'm you know, conceding this election. I think it's an honorable tradition. I think it's a nice tradition. I think it helps the country think through what it means to have had a hard-fought campaign and now for us hopefully all to unite in a certain way around a president, whether we voted for that president or not. So I think it's a norm of great value, but it's definitely just a norm. It has no effect on all of the pieces of an admittedly convoluted system that I think the three of us have at least succinctly, if not totally effectively, tried to describe in the beginning of this conversation. That is not a part specified by statute. It has no effect under state law as they choose their electors. It has certainly no effect under the 12th Amendment and the joint session of Congress that Adav spoke to. I use that as just an example because we often treat it as maybe the moment in which we realize that the cycle is done, and yet it is pure norm and 0% law. And I think clarifying that in a time when the norms are being smashed really by one candidate, I think it's always important to recognize this is not a both sides thing, by one candidate, to clarify what the norms are and where the law is, I think that's critical.
Gupta mentioned that some states may choose to pre-process, meaning those states can count provisional and mail-in ballots before the election instead of waiting until weeks after the election to count all the votes. Here she is.
And there's active litigation in a number of states right now around allowing pre-processing of ballots before, I mean, pre meaning pre-November 3rd. But there is, I mean, in these states, there's been a lot of concern about the fact that, you know, there's going to be a surge in mail-in balloting. They're battleground states. Secretaries of states in these states are making preparations to be able to support local election officials in doing the count effectively, expeditiously. They are all in conversation, understanding, this is Republican and Democratic secretaries of states in conversation, understanding the kind of anticipation that the whole country will be having related to this. And so they have been setting up systems, even where they aren't allowing pre-processing, to have efficient counting of the ballots. And the primaries were, in a lot of ways, our preparation ground for some of those states. Wisconsin in the primary, I think, took a week to count their, to announce the results. And they've been taking steps to prepare to do this even sooner. So even for states that don't have the pre-processing, one thing is some of them may move and change between now and November 3rd even to be able to allow that because of litigation. And then the other thing is that they are taking steps, even if they don't have that, to allow for, you know, support of local election officials to do this expeditiously. A lot of the litigation that's happening right now is an effort to preempt and prevent post-November 3rd challenges. But we also know that there are folks are going to be bringing challenges to bring challenges, perhaps, and to kind of, you know, gum up the process. But it is important to see the trends right now in the litigation and the outcomes, where a lot of these challenges from the RNC are actually failing I wouldn't say uniformly, but pretty across the board around the country right now. So I just wanted to put a pin in. The Brennan Center's got a really good litigation tracker for any of you that are interested in seeing them.
Lastly, Geltzer talked about what happens in the event that the current president calls into question the election results. Would that affect other elections that may be on the ballot?
Initial thought is that we're already beginning to see a little bit of a diversion of interests here between Donald Trump and even some of his closest supporters. There were at least reports that Minority Leader McCarthy was quietly urging Republicans in various key states to use mail-in voting, precisely because mail-in voting is reliable and it's safe, especially for certain Republican constituencies, especially in certain states that are really having particularly hard time with the pandemic right now. I use that just to illustrate the point that it's not clear that it's in the interest of those for whom a full counting might actually ensure down-ballot re-election or down-ballot allies getting re-elected, that essentially trying to burn the whole thing down, to cast doubt on the whole project of voting in America, which is what Donald Trump seems to do with some of his comments, that that's a shared interest for them. I don't think it is. And while I'm not naive about the likelihood of allies breaking with Donald Trump, at least until it's clear that he's lost, I do think there's a potential diversion of interest there. And perhaps that combination of departing interests and just a fundamental commitment, whatever party one is aligned with, to seeing a result we all can trust and a peaceful transfer of power, if there is a transfer, will lead folks to back away from some of Trump's more incendiary and irresponsible rhetoric on this stuff.
The National Task Force on Election Crises meets weekly leading up to the November 3rd election. Stay tuned to KBOO for more updates from this important group.
Hi, my name is Dr. Mark Allendary, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19.
You can find more information about this show and our other daily live updates and Q&A show at noisefiltershow.com.
So let's get started.
Hello, Doc Griggs. We are back for at least what is one of my favorite segments on the show, and that is reviewing the public health studies for the past week.
That's always fun.
All right, let's get started. I just wanted to say first that there was a great story in the New York Times. If you're interested, it's called The Pandemic from the Virus's Point of View. It really looks at things from a viral perspective. And when I teach my HIV courses and hepatitis C courses, I always talk about things from the perspective of the virus, and that one is really good. And if I can make a second recommendation, Doc Griggs, right here, our very own Doc Griggs, wrote a great op-ed in the local paper here. It's called The Advocate. Please look for it. And it's called Do Not Let Vaccination Slip or Worse Shape Medically as a Society. Doc Griggs, in 1 minute, what could you tell us about that?
It's just the fact that everyone's getting lax with everything that's going on with the vaccines. We have a lot of things going on, especially down here in South Louisiana with hurricanes and vaccines and COVID. Oh my, a lot of people are afraid to step back and thinking that if they do, it might be okay. But now more than ever, it's the most important that you get your vaccine, your flu shot, your pneumonia shot, your regular vaccines for kids and students. It's most important. The more you do, the less COVID can do.
That's right. So let's get started really quickly. We have three big topics we're going to talk about. The first one is going to be a viral load. So what's a viral load? A viral load is the amount of virus that's inside of you. And what we've seen in cases for people living with HIV, and we've seen it certainly with Ebola, was that the higher a inoculation of a viral load there is, the more damage over the long run, and particularly the greater the likelihood of mortality. In fact, somebody could die with, or the more severe the disease. And so there were a couple studies here that we're going to quickly review. One essentially looked at individuals that were admitted in a hospital in China, and then what they essentially found was the higher the viral load, the more severe the disease. So it makes sense, right?
It makes sense. The more soldiers there are to attack you, the more damage that they do, and the higher the likelihood that you could die or be mortally wounded.
That's exactly right. So a second study was done, except this was done here in a U.S. hospital, and it essentially found the same thing, that there was a greater likelihood for severity of disease, but they also looked at mortality, and what they found was in this study was that the viral load predicted mortality, much like what we've seen in cases like Ebola or in HIV, the higher viral load, there's a greater likelihood of mortality sooner.
Yeah, the more lethal soldiers you have attacking you, the higher the likelihood that you might not survive.
And the last study really was a very elegant study. It was released last week. It was in a journal called Cancer Cell, and it essentially was looking at those people that have cancer. So now what happens when you take people with cancer, and people with cancer, as we know, are immunodeficient. In other words, their immune system already suffers as a result of having a state of cancer. And what they found was that people with the highest viral loads were those people with cancer, and they had the highest mortality. But when they looked at the general population, the highest viral loads also had the highest mortality. When they looked at people who had medium viral loads, they had second highest mortality. And when they looked at people with the lowest viral loads, they had the lowest mortality. In other words, they were more likely to survive. Yeah. So it seems very much that viral load of COVID, so the amount of virus that you have in you, will predict not only how severe the disease is, but what the likelihood is for mortality.
Yeah, especially when you're talking about diseases or pathologies like cancer. If you already have your army fighting a war, if a large army comes for a battle that's extremely lethal while you're distracted or already tired from fighting the war, higher the likelihood that you could die.
That's right. So let's move into our next topic, which is viral transmission, something that we love to talk about a lot. And essentially, we love talking about how a virus transmits from one individual to the other, because as public health practitioners, that's important for the work that we do.
The virus doesn't spread the virus. People spread the virus.
So we talked way, way back when in the early, early episodes of Noise Filter about a news correspondent.
That seems so long ago.
It was a news correspondent from New York City who came to New Orleans in a crowded flight prior to the onset of mask wearing and or mask requirements in flights. And he ended up getting COVID-19. When he returned back to New York City. Again, he was a news correspondent. He was an infectious diseases epidemiologist. So he really was aware. And he really believed that the transmission occurred via ocular, through his eyes. Right. And so this study here really actually lends some support. And what this study did, it wasn't the highest quality of studies, but it was a very, very good study. It was in JAMA, the Journal of Medical Association. And essentially what it showed was there was a hospital in China. And essentially what they did was, and it was a hospital that had a lot of COVID, they looked at those individuals that wore glasses. They looked at those individuals that were in a COVID-19 ward for some time. And what they found was that those people who had COVID versus those people who didn't have COVID, those people that had COVID were less likely by a significant amount to not wear glasses. In other words, it seems as though that wearing glasses actually may protect, or a face mask may protect. And we do know that ACE2 is on the surface of the eyeball. It's on the conjunctiva, and ACE2 is what the virus uses to get in.
To attach. So there is some level of protection. So the things that we don't think about that could be protected, the barriers, actually do work. And the longer we're in this, the more data we'll find.
That's exactly right. So the next study essentially was one that I thought was really interesting, but it really drives home what we already know. In Atlanta, they looked at 24 shelters, homeless shelters, and what they found was those individuals that were sheltered indoors that were homeless versus those that were sheltered outdoors. And what they found was a huge difference. Those that were sheltered indoors, those people who experienced homelessness, were more likely to develop COVID than those people who shelter outdoors. So this really drives home the point, something we make all the time, that it's indoors and it's poorly ventilated, indoor crowded spaces, especially if you're not wearing masks. Doc?
Yeah, which really worries me for the upcoming season, because as we take care of those that are less fortunate than ourselves, We want to bring them inside, and we definitely don't want the cold air coming in. So we just need to brace ourselves and learn how to mask up.
Absolutely. Go down. Just real quickly, two very, very quick studies looking at airplanes, again, under viral transmission. These were two studies that came out last week that basically looked at transmission of virus before masks were worn. They were both published by the CDC. And so essentially what made these two studies unique was one showed airborne transmission and the other one was linked genetically. Both of them essentially show that prior to using masks, that airplanes and flights were likely a transmission.
So it's the best of both worlds. You got an epidemiology study and you have a biology and genetic study. And folks, it's the same thing. So you better believe it.
That's right. So lastly, let's talk about COVID-19 and misinformation vaccine updates. So a great study came out last week that essentially, and it was published by major universities such as Harvard, Rutgers, Northwestern University, Northeastern University, just very, very, very well-known universities. And what it showed was that Generation Z, or what we refer to as Zoomers, are more likely to believe in COVID misinformation. And they overwhelmingly, more than any other age group, had misbeliefs or disbeliefs associated with COVID.
Yeah, are we really surprised there, though? That age group doesn't believe us anyway about anything. It's raining. No, it's not.
So there you go. So we really need to be very, very careful. And we need to also recognize that managing misinformation is as important as managing the pandemic.
It can be really dangerous because data and information are what govern policy.
Lastly, I just want to talk about the vaccine update of last week, which is also showed that this Johnson & Johnson vaccine is very important. It's in phase 3. They are looking to enroll more participants than any of the other vaccines. So they're looking to do 60,000 participants. But there's two very clear things that I want you guys to be aware of. One is that it's a one-dose vaccine, at least that's what they're testing now, mm-hmm. as opposed to two doses. And then the other thing is that it does not require sub-zero refrigeration.
Which is
really big, that it only requires just a standard fridge that does not require these minus 70 degrees as some of these other vaccines are doing. So some good news there.
Yeah, we don't want to forget the scale of things. Folks, the simple things that might cost an extra $100 here or there for a sub-zero refrigerator is a resource that has to be replicated all over the world when we're thinking about this. So yeah, the little things matter.
Not only that, but also it would be a lot easier to do 7.8 billion doses than 7.8? So that's 15.
It's 15.6.
Yeah. So anyway, thank you guys for tuning in. We'll be back tomorrow with our regular show. Doc Riggs, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. Dr. Darry and I have a daily show at 4 p.m. Central Standard Time where we go into more detail on stories and answer your questions about COVID-19.
You can find Doc Griggs at DocGriggs1.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information